tell you where we're at on the agenda. House Bill 3642, which is the criminal forfeiture bill, if any of you are here from that or here for that, the parties that are working on that bill came to me late yesterday and indicated that they believe that we are getting closer on that bill, but we're not ready to essentially work the bill today. So we will not be going to work session on House Bill 3642. Other than that, I think we're going to at least have some level of discussion on each of the bills up for work session today. I'm going to start with House Bill 2877 and open a work session. I understand we have a few people who wanted to come forward and testify briefly on this bill. We had to cut part of the testimony short, you might recall, from the hearing we had on this bill last week. So
I had to leave too, Mr. Chair. I don't have some information I have lacking on that.
Okay, great. Mr. Kafoury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here this morning representing the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. I appreciate the chair's courtesy in allowing us to testify this morning. My client was in Albuquerque, and we had a couple of people come and testify, you may recall, talking about the program aspects of the Children's Trust Fund, the work that we do around the state, passing monies through to local communities to do work with prevention and care of children who are in abuse situations, preventing those situations. This morning, Cindy Thompson is here, who's the executive director of the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon, and we're not going to talk any more about all the good works that we do. I think you've heard plenty of that, but to talk a little more seriously about the history of the trust fund, how we happen to be where we are, and what our budgetary situation is, what the implications of this bill would be on our organization. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, Representative Williams and committee members. My name is Cynthia Thompson. I'm the director of the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. Last week, we submitted formal written testimony. Today, I'd like to highlight a few of those points to explain a little bit further about the House bill and the implications for the trust fund. The Children's Trust Fund was established by the Oregon Legislature in 1985. It was the result of a national emphasis on states to create some form of prevention. In those days, the reports about child abuse and neglect were swelling, and states were wondering how to deal with this social concern. And the federal government encouraged each state to set up some form of trust or prevention fund, which would be used in order to prevent the occurrence of child abuse and neglect. Oregon's was set up to be a public-private partnership. There are many models of trust funds. They vary around the state. By a public-private partnership, it was believed that if the state resources were put forth, that private donations would follow, which would increase the resources available for programs throughout the state. The trust fund was unique in that it was the only state agency that was targeted towards the reduction of child abuse and neglect on a statewide basis. Throughout the years, it was umbrellaed under other larger state agencies, but in 1995, the Oregon Legislature determined that it should become an independent state agency. Over the years, the trust fund has worked to increase the private revenues, and I'm pleased to say that last year we garnered successfully about $500,000, and that money was put back into the local community. Now, this money doesn't come in big chunks. What it represents is thousands of people who dedicate amounts through their payroll deductions or through tax checkoffs or simply donations in order to ensure that we have prevention programs in our local communities. In 1995, at the same time the trust fund was made to be an independent state agency, the legislature created the Children's Trust Endowment Fund. The reasoning behind this was that they wanted to ensure that there was some source of perpetual funding available for prevention programs in Oregon. And they determined that this would be funded through a fractional percentage of the criminal fees and fines. Initially, it was slightly over 2%. That's been reduced. Currently, it's about 2%. We submitted the enabling legislation to you with our testimony in order to illustrate what the scheme was. And it was stated that the trust fund could use a portion of the criminal fines for the reasonable operating costs of the agency, which was upholding the public partnership. Secondly, the remainder of the money was to be deposited into an endowment fund, which was to grow. It was to grow indefinitely. There was not a cap placed on it. However, it states that when the fund reached $5 million, the Board of Trustees could use 80% of the investment earnings of that fund in a way to support the mission of the agency. And our board has determined that that money should be combined with the privately generated revenues and used as grants. it was hoped that that money would increase either the amounts of money we're able to give out or to increase the numbers of projects that we're able to maintain in the state. Last year we had approximately 33 projects located in 24 counties throughout the state of Oregon. In accordance with that, we have used the money for the reasonable operating costs. The remainder is an investment account. It's invested in according to state investment policy. in 1999, the trust fund had studied the possibilities of privatization. I think from what you can have heard, the trust fund is really more like a public charity. We've had a 501c3 since 1991, and we use that fully in our fundraising efforts on behalf of our local projects. Senator Neil Bryan had a bill and asked if he could sponsor the privatization of the trust fund. We asked, in accordance with that process, that we have a 2-year period as a semi-independent state agency in order to responsibly transition the fund into the private sector. And we have been busy over the last 2 years getting that done. In fact, yesterday we just got our new 501c3. We've created new bylaws and a new corporate structure that will become effective July 1. The privatization, a portion of that was submitted with a testimony, and as you can see on that, there was no intent in the privatization to reduce any of the state obligations towards the funding of child abuse prevention. It was our belief that privatization would allow us to fully direct our small staff to the mission of the agency rather than trying to meet the demands on every state agency. And also it would allow us to more fully perform fundraising in the community. It was our intent and our belief that the public-private partnership was to be maintained. I have to say that one of the most appealing points for us as we engage in fundraising, especially through workplaces with citizens, is the fact that the state of Oregon has supported the operating costs and 100% of any donation goes back into the local communities in the forms of grants. I've heard a couple comments about the criminal fees and fines, which I'd like to address. One is that there is an interest in being accountable. On behalf of the trust fund, I want to say that we hire on an annual basis an independent evaluator whose job it is to go out to work with our local projects to ensure that they are being effective with the clients they're serving, and that our efforts are being effective in the sense of working with at-risk families who are able to increase their skills, manage their children, keep their kids from going into either out-of-home placements or being harmed. And our data shows that 95% to 98% of those families, many of whom are very highly at-risk families, are successful in the projects. Second thing has to do with the criminal fees and fines being somewhat of a pork barrel. It's my experience, both with the trust fund as well as the other entities, that we are placed there through some well-reasoned discussion through elected bodies. We are not plunked on there with little effort. Both in 1995, I know that the legislature seriously looked at the problems of prevention and how to fund that, and it was chosen that this was a stream of money that would best meet that need. I believe that the governor's office intends for this to be somewhat of a public safety focus. I know of no more compelling issue than the protection of children and vulnerable families, and to me, that is an extremely serious public safety measure. I thank you for the opportunity to clarify these points. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair, I did want to add one particular point. There's another bill that's companion bill to this. It's in Ways and Means Budget Bill. And what would happen with this bill, to pass, and the budget bill as well, we would be taken off of the criminal assessment fund. We would have received $1.2 million this next biennium coming up. Instead, we would be getting, according to the budget figure, $500,000, which is a $700,000 cut. So we would be getting $700,000 less should these two bills pass. Plus, we would not have this situation of the funding going on into the future from the trust fund. So there's an immediate problem as well as a long-term problem from passage of these two bills.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for either of these witnesses?
I have a question about the amendments.
Representing, which one? The Dash 3s?
Yes.
Those amendments aren't really up for consideration today, Representative Dinkfelder. I'd be happy to talk to you about them some other time. But we're not likely going to work the bill actually today in any way, shape, or form, as I understand it. So thank you. Questions, Representative Lowe?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have Representative Schrader, who I'm going to allow to come forward now and testify. We had to cut off his testimony midstream last week on this issue as there was a call of the House, and we did not reconvene. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Representative Kurt Schrader. I'm from House District 23. I'd like to give you a little bit of the Ways and Means perspective on why this issue is even before this committee. I start off last time by saying it became apparent last session in the Ways and Means process, where I served on the Public Safety Subcommittee that heard the budget bill for the criminal fines and assessment account, that we had some issues going on with regard to, several different issues. One was the collection of the fines in the first place, which we've tried to address, and this committee may want to further address or inquire into. And also then with how this account, what this account's goal and purpose was. There were several bills introduced last session to add to the list of programs that would be funded out of the criminal fines and assessment account. It became a very popular vehicle to fund programs one could not get into the general fund or thought that they couldn't get into the general fund. And the concern that many of our committee members had was that the priority mission of that body of money was being diluted, and diluted dramatically. From our standpoint, it was very apparent, based on previous sessions and the thoughts, at least of the 99 legislature, that the top two priorities would be the DPSST training that we're lagging behind. I think you've heard testimony on that, and also the victims assistance types of programs, including the CAMI programs, the compensation account, the domestic violence program, sexual assault. Those seem to be the top priorities. That was the original genesis, if you will, of the criminal fines and assessment account. Last session, caps were put on the account. That raised quite a stir among many of the participants or beneficiaries, if you will, of the revenues from that account. And that was done because what was happening, based on just the strict percentages that were applied here, that there was no budgetary accountability, that money would just roll up in various accounts and be divvied up to the different organizations based on just the fact that, you know, they had a certain percentage, regardless as to what programs they were doing, what their goals were. And in the Ways and Means, we thought that it would probably be advisable for these individuals, these groups, to sit down before the legislature in some manner and explain what their goals and standards were so that these programs could at least have some rational basis for continuing on in a certain manner. There's certainly no end of good that one can do if one's given more money each legislative session. And I think that's great, but the bottom line here was to have a little accountability and a little reporting, if you will, to the legislature about, you know, what are the priorities. And it is our job, I believe, as the state legislature to establish those priorities. So the caps were a way to kind of at least put some fiscal accountability, very crude, perhaps, manner and approach to it until we had time during the interim in the work group that the governor's office and others have alluded to come up with a better model that allow the various groups and projects to continue, but in a more thoughtful manner. So, long story short, we came up with this interim work group, had legislators, myself, Representative Patridge, and Representative Westland, in addition to the governor's office and other interested parties around the building, to try and come up with a mechanism to protect the top priorities, establish some fiscal accountability, and allow the existing programs to at least receive the same amount of money that they did last session. So no one's getting any less money, contrary to what you may hear, no one's getting any less money than they did last time. Our tentative thought for a budgetary model, at least, to distribute this money was to make it clear in statute that there were basically three tiers of priorities for unitary assessment. The first tier would be public safety training, and that is, as you've heard, I think already, the DPSST facility. We're trying to get our training up from, I think, 10 weeks to at least 16, with most states, of course, being at 24. This is a very large endeavor. Much work needs to be done on that, but it has been the top priority for the last couple of sessions. The second tier that would get funded before anything else below it would be the Victims of Crime account, and that I alluded to would be the CAMI project, the Criminal Injuries Compensation, Domestic Violence, the Child Abuse Medical Assessment Teams, Sexual Assault, and also the CAMI Regional Assessment Centers. The tentative thinking here is to break that out, because that is a goal for several of the different community organizations, is to have their own assessment center. Quite frankly, I'm convinced, as I think most members of Ways and Means are, this is an outstanding program. Then there'd be a third tier, and the tentative thinking at this point in time, and we really need your input on this, is that we'd have one-time public safety grants. And what this allows for is innovative new public safety ideas to come forward, be funded out of the criminal fines and assessment account, the unitary assessment, if you will, and see if these, quite frankly, see if these programs have legs. If they have legs, then hopefully they'll be picked up next session in the general fund. And there's no guarantee that they will be refunded next time. This is to try some ideas out, to be a little creative, be a little innovative, with a small amount of money, if you will, and again allow the creative uses of this legislature to move forward. Under this particular bill, there are a number of accounts that we suggest move to the general fund. That would be your intoxicated driver program, the forensics program, the OSPIT program, the commercial vehicle enforcement program, and the rural EMS and the health division EMS programs. They already have, basically, in a lot of these, for instance, they should be in the state police budget, or they should be in the health division budget. They don't belong in this particular budget. there are several others that we raise a question as to whether or not it's the goal of the state legislature to continue to fund them. I think the current thinking is to allow them to stay in the general fund budget. That would be the Children's Trust Fund that you've talked about, and several other programs, that, you know, safety education, and I think there's probably a couple others that we're also talking about. There have been several new programs suggested to be funded either in the general fund or in these one-time grants. That would be the race-based policing studies, that would be the LEDS program, arrest and return, and then there's a proposal on my part and Representative Patridge's part to augment the domestic violence program. And that's a policy decision, I think, that we all have to make here, and a limited amount of money. But the most important thing, I think, is to try and come up with a budget model that allows certain priorities to continue, encourages creativity for one-time public safety grants. We need the definition of what the public safety category would be. That could be a wide open area, and certainly we'd look to this committee to help define that a little more clearly for future legislative sessions. But in a nutshell, that's kind of where we are. I guess I'd entertain any questions and any concerns the committee might have.
Any questions for Representative Schrader, Representative Ackerman?
Yes, Representative Schrader, on page 2 of the bill, sub 4, you say that the Assembly, or the bill says, the Assembly must first allocate sufficient money to pay debt service obligations authorized by prior sessions of the Legislative Assembly or Emergency Board action. Could you explain what you mean by that? I don't understand what those two categories of fund uses might be.
I guess I would probably defer to DAS or LFO on that, but to the extent that we have continuing debt service, obligated debt service, that would obviously have to take priority. In terms
debt
of
service
money.
On what?
I don't. I'd have to ask DAS and the governor's office.
Yeah.
We have, I think it's $900,000 or so on the startup cost of DPSST at this point.
On what, sir?
Public safety and training facility.
Well, I don't know what you mean when you say debt service and you say startup costs. I'm confused as to those terms.
At this point in time, there's been a lot of discussion. It's been very interesting discussion we've had on where the new training facility will be located and what the cost of and scope of such a facility will be. We've already done some preliminary work last session to plan and get our hands around that. Different legislators have different ideas about where this facility should be located, what should be included in the training of, program for this facility. So we've done some work last session. That's the current debt service we're talking about. There'd be quite a bit more debt service, probably in the neighborhood of $4 or $5 million. If we move forward with the current thinking that I understand the department has with their new built-out facility. But you're going to be hearing a lot about that this session.
Further question?
I just want to make sure I understand what we're buying here. I think you're saying that we need a training facility for the state police, and what you want to be able to do is establish a priority on this account to pay for any debt service arising out of the planning or construction of that facility.
That is correct.
And yet, there's nothing here where we know what the outside limit of that obligation may be.
That's a very good point. And I think what we need to do this session is kind of define that limit in its entirety. That'll be a budgetary decision. Diane Middleton is working hard, but it's a little tough to, in her defense, I think, to come up with an absolute number when we don't even have the location decided yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I would agree with you, Representative Ackerman, Mr. Chair, that we need to establish the scope of this facility.
Wouldn't you conclude, then, the main purpose of this bill is to create a funding mechanism for the police training facility?
Well, it's not just, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, it's not just for the police. This is a public safety training facility. There are two top priorities in our proposal. One is that facility, and two would be the criminal victims' assistance.
But the priority in the distribution of these funds would go first to pay debt service obligations on the training facility.
That is correct. That is correct.
Any further questions? Representative Dingfelder.
I have one, Representative Schrader. I wanted to find out about when you talked about some of the programs, such as the Children's Trust Fund, that would be funded through the general fund, and that's for this budget cycle. So So what kind of assurances do we have that in future budgets that these programs would be funded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkelder, the fact that I've yet to see too many programs get cut from the general fund once they're in would be some assurance, but there is no absolute insurance. They would have to compete just like every other program, just like every other program does, for its relative revenues in this state legislature. I think that's appropriate.
Representative Krieger.
Chair, I think Representative Schrader, my question would be just about the same for rural communities, emergency services. I understand it would go into the budget of what the health division? Could
yes.
be in health division?
Right.
There's no assurance.
Or HSU.
And I'm not certain who the, you know, unless you have the rural people come in and lobby the health people that it could be, that funding could be lost very easily, I think.
There's no doubt about it, colleagues. This is an opportunity for us to either continue adding things slowly but surely. That particular program was added just this last session, the largesse of one of our colleagues that felt this was extremely important, and certainly I think it is. We have an opportunity here to either step forward and make some tough choices, to be quite frank, because this money, limited amount of money that it is, we're talking about $113 million overall, some of which does get transferred anywhere in the 50 to 58%, depending on what particular budget scenario you're looking at, gets transferred to the general fund anyway. But this is, I'll just lay it out. It's just up to you and hopefully us as a legislature to decide what are the priorities. Is it the status quo here, or are we going to prioritize what this account was originally set up for? And I would argue that it was originally set up for DPSST and criminal victims. If we want to just add anything in here, then I've got a veterinary college that I think I'd like to fund through the unitary assessment, because obviously it's a very worthwhile program. And not that I apologize for being a little facetious here, but this is a time, a little gut check on my colleagues. Are we going to use this for just whatever program Kurt Schrader or whoever would like to have put in here, or are we going to make some decisions about what this account is supposed to be used for? Another model that was talked about is just to use the unitary assessment money, much like we do lottery funds or tobacco money, because it's part of the general pot. And everyone then competes on the same basis. That was another proposal that was entertained. But we did feel, at least trying to keep in concert with the intent of past legislatures, that there were some priorities that this particular account probably should be used for. And, again, you've heard a lot of testimony on that the last 2 days.
Any questions from this side of the dais? Kurt, my recollection is last year we put the cap on them, but we also made the collection of the assessment mandatory on courts. Is that right?
That is correct. And Mr. Chair, even still there has been, in the interim, came to light that there was still some confusion, despite the mandatory language that was put into law on the part of some of the judges as to whether or not they had to assess these fines if they assessed the penalties.
How much, by making it mandatory, how much additional revenue did we generate? Do you recall?
I don't recall offhand, but we have some graphs that, again, the governor's office could probably share with you that showed a dramatic increase in our collections. Even as we speak through the biennium here, there's been another $3 million since the beginning of this biennium that's been collected above what we had expected.
In last session, did we do anything to capture that additional increase that we were going to get off the mandatory imposition of this penalty to any of the public safety programs that we're talking about today?
It goes into this account and could be allocated as the legislature decides.
But was it? I mean, my recollection is I think we collected about somewhere in the neighborhood of around $20 million additional dollars. And did that money actually get allocated for any of these programs, or did that money just essentially go over the wall into the general fund?
At this point in time, it's anticipated in the governor's budget, and it's already been set for allocation. Steve Marks, come up, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Steve. You'd identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Steve Marks, Governor's Senior Policy Advisor. I think that's right. Last time, any money above the caps that came in, that additional $20 million, went into the general fund. We've recaptured, this legislation would actually recapture that as we did with the caps. So that would change that drifting of the money over the wall from CFA to the general fund, and that was one of the reasons the governor, when he signed Senate Bill 82, wrote a letter in signing it, not a veto letter, but an acceptance letter about why he was signing it and why he thought it was important. And one of the things he said is that he wanted to stop that diversion of money to the general fund and bring it back to fund public safety programs.
But at least the money that came through in the current biennium went over the wall into the general fund.
Yes.
And the governor's office and the Ways and Means Committee currently has allocated that money, at least over the last 2 years, that money was allocated to non-public safety-related programs in the mix. Nobody took that $20 million and said, we're going to stick it in a fund for DPSST, did
yes,
they?
Yes, that's true, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We have three other people who have asked to come forward and testify. Karen Whitaker, Jeff Butler, and Joanne Fairchild. And if there's anybody else here who didn't get a chance to testify when we closed the hearing down last time who wants to, you need to either raise your hand or send a note up here. Why don't we start with Ms. Whitaker?
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I genuinely appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today, that you've taken the time. A lot of people have written to you about the Rural Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account, I know, and a lot of people have written to me, and so I appreciate the opportunity to express their point of view. I'm also aware of the difficult choices that you have to make. But I do want you to understand that if you pass 2877, that there will be no firm assurance that this account will continue to exist. With all due respect to Representative Schrader, that will be a decision of the Ways and Means Committee, and we have no assurance that will occur. I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on this account and the work that has been done with it. It was established by Senate Bill 911 last session, and it transfers a little over 2%, 2.0781% of the criminal fines and assessment account to the Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account with a cap of $1,876,822. The money is distributed four ways. 35% of it goes to the Office of Rural Health, of which I am the director. 35% of it goes to the Area Health Education Centers program. 25% goes to the Health Division. And 5% goes to the Oregon Poison Center at Oregon Health Sciences University. And I just wanted to briefly give you some information on how those funds have been spent so far. We certainly invite your scrutiny, because we have spent them, we think, very responsibly and very carefully. In our office, with the exception of about $500 we've spent for printing and mailing, every penny of this money has gone to rural communities to buy mainly medical equipment, emergency medical services equipment, that they could not otherwise afford to purchase. And I've given you a packet here that has a list of some of the features of what we have done with the funds in the Office of Rural Health. We've spent $1,152,495 overall with the money so far in 34 Oregon counties. Our office has spent $585,941. We have received applications from the rural communities totaling almost $3 million, and of course we have not been able to fund but about 20% of those requests. The agencies that apply for our help at the Office of Rural Health are overwhelmingly small, remote, and staffed by volunteers. More than half, 54% of them, have no paid staff at all. Many of them are just 2- and 3-person quick response teams who are totally self-funded and totally volunteer. Our average applicant agency has 11 volunteer EMTs and 7 volunteer first responders. And applicants for our funds so far serve a total of about 73,000 rural Oregonians annually. Each applicant serves an average of 837 patients each year. And it's important to point out that many of these patients are from the metro areas of the state and are traveling in rural parts of Oregon as well. The average applicant for the funds that we supervise has operating expenses that exceed operating revenues for an average operating deficit of nearly $30,000 per year per applicant. Many of these small, isolated emergency medical services agencies have no budgeted funds. They are totally voluntary. They depend on local donations. And because many of them are not transporting agencies, they may have a quick response vehicle, a four-wheel drive vehicle that will go out and respond to an incident, but they don't actually transport, then they cannot bill for their services. So they are completely dependent on whatever donations they get and whatever monies they can raise in that way. It's almost impossible for these small organizations to raise the $80,000, for example, necessary to purchase an ambulance. And many of them are driving vehicles that are unlicensable and that are unsafe. I've included for you a map of how the funds have been distributed. We have so far bought 6 ambulances, 3 casualty response vehicles, 17 defibrillators, 84 pager systems, 19 radio systems, 3 jaws of life extrication devices, and so on. This gives you a rundown of how the money has been spent. And this next spreadsheet gives you an idea of every single applicant, where they are from, how much they asked for, if we were able to fund them, and what they used the money for. I've also included a group of letters that people have written to us. Some of the recipients of the funds in our office have written to us to let us know how this money was spent. And I think it's very interesting to note that these are certainly public safety issues when you read over these letters. The first letter is from the Gates Fire Department in Gates, Oregon, and Gary Swanson, who talks about an accident where they were able to use the hydraulic rescue tools, or the jaws of life, as we call them, to save a driver who otherwise may have not made it through this accident because of the delay involved. There's an interesting letter here from the people in John Day who talk about a very complicated rescue that was made of a hunter who had a heart attack. And they needed some rather complicated radio communications in order to bring in a helicopter to get this hunter out. And if they hadn't had the radio equipment that we were able to purchase for them, they likely would not have been able to rescue this person. And I will leave it to you to I know you don't have a lot of spare time, but to read these letters. It's actually just almost heartbreaking to read through all these applications and know that we can't fund but such a small percentage of them. So I hope that you will consider the impact of this portion of House Bill 2877 and understand that this certainly is a public safety issue.
Thank you very much.
The opportunity to share that with you.
Ms. Whitaker. Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I will just take a couple of minutes to elaborate on some things that Karen Whitaker talked about. I don't think we can stress strongly enough that in small rural communities, EMS, emergency medical services, is clearly part of the public safety infrastructure of that community, along with law enforcement and other types of programs. The fact is, in a survey done before the passage of SB 911, statewide of rural EMS services, we discovered that 84% of the workforce for rural EMS were volunteers. And of that, that workforce, those EMS agencies were operating at about 60% of the workforce they really needed to provide adequate services in those communities. 28% of that rural EMS, primarily volunteer workforce, turns over every year. And the reasons for that is because they are volunteers. These are the people that have Sunday morning pancake breakfasts and so forth to cover the costs of training that they need to operate the equipment that the Office of Rural Health is attempting to provide for them through their SB 911 funds. One of the reasons for the turnover among rural EMS agencies is because for volunteers, the cost of travel, tuition, books to receive the training to operate in their local agencies is borne by the volunteer. With the passage of SB 911 and the therefore the availability of funding, we, for the first time ever, been able to address some of these issues of volunteer EMTs. To date, the 911 funded initiative for training EMTs has certified or has trained 867 volunteers across the state. That was the first year of the biennium. We anticipate training another 570 this second year of the biennium. It's going to have a big impact on the capacity of these agencies to provide the services that the communities need. And like Ms. Whitaker, I would urge you to seriously consider the implications of the passage of 2877 and the impact it would have on emergency medical services in rural Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Ms. Fairchild.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Fairchild. I am the Trauma Nurse Coordinator responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital, and I direct the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program, which is a statewide injury prevention education program. And I, in your packets that you should have gotten last Thursday, it lists all the people in this state that are currently teaching our program around this state. I'm going to skip most of my testimony in the essence of time, other than to tell you that this program was recognized by the state risk management as a program that works. And in their latest risky notes, there's an article about our program. In addition to that, we are one of only three safety education programs in the country to be listed in a report to the President and the Congress on Buckle Up America. So that's my pitch for my program. And 50%, over 50% of students at every age group says that this is the program that works. This bill and the accompanying House Bill 5010 cuts funding for the Safety Education Fund at Department of Transportation by 50% in the next biennium. My program is one of two that's funded in this fund. The other one is Think First. Both of these programs are statewide programs, and in the time that we have been in existence, we have gone from 112 15 to 19-year-olds dying in traffic crashes to 37 in 1999. And while my program certainly doesn't claim total credit for this, we are a big part of what is causing this change for our youth. My program, I believe, and Think First are perfect fits for criminal fees and assessments. We are out in the schools teaching youth why we have the traffic laws that we do, and that you don't just follow them because you might get a ticket. You follow the laws because you could cause somebody else's death or your own or lifelong disability. I did include in the packet some letters from students at just one high school that show that not only are students paying attention to this message and changing their behavior, but they're using the knowledge that they gain to influence their friends in a positive way. I ask you to continue the funding for this very important program that I believe is saving the Oregon Health Plan millions of dollars and, more importantly, saving lives in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fairchild. Are there any questions? Representative Krieger.
Chair, they've brought up some of the issues that are kind of dear to my heart, in that having been a police officer, I depended on these type of people from rural fire districts, volunteers to come on the scene of these bad accidents. And then recently in Curry County, we've had several car fires where actually who shows up first, because we have lack of sheriff's numbers, lack of state police on rural areas. These are the people that show up on the scene oftentimes before the police get there. So we are very dependent on them. I look at it as a public safety issue in that you have fire and police, and who supports both of them is medical services. And we, many of our small communities have had hospitals close, and as a result of it, I think it's a very, very, very important part. I would like to see something in this bill that kind of includes that as part of the public safety thing within that bill and not put it in to the general fund. I'd like to have some conversation with some people about that before we're done.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here who did not have an opportunity to testify or make a comment on House Bill 2877 at the last hearing or wishes to do so today? Okay, with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2877. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3446. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3446 comes to you from Representative Devlin and directs the Department of Corrections and the Oregon State Hospital to establish sex offender treatment pilot program. You have the dash two amendments in front of you. We have Dr. Gary Field here from the Department of Corrections, and I don't know whether there's anyone from the Oregon State Hospital. You should have.
For 3446, I have dash ones.
Yeah, I got dash ones. Dr. Field, would you come forward? There's supposed to be dash two.
Twos?
Yeah. Three, twos or threes?
I've got three.
For 3446?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Do you have twos? Dr. Field, have you seen the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
Okay.
These came from Representative Devlin.
Shannon, I have a copy of the dash two. Did you get copies?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I could go through them.
Okay, while she's getting copies, why don't you sort of brief us, counsel, on what they are?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash two amendments, I believe, come from Representative Devlin, and what they would do, let me read it. The director of the Department of Corrections, and it takes out, and in consultation with the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, shall conduct a study concerning feasibility of establishment a sex offender treatment pilot program within the adult male correctional facility. Then it would say that would include effective assessment of sex offenders to identify those sex offenders who are most likely to benefit from treatment, B, provide treatment to those offenders who are most likely to benefit from treatment, C, provide a narrow range of treatment alternatives in a residential treatment setting for a period of 18 to 24 months, and D, include long-term supervision outpatient treatment for sex offender participating in the programs after the sex offender has been released from incarceration. Two, directs the director and the superintendent shall develop criteria by which the efficacy of the programs would be measured. And I believe these amendments, Dr. Field, aren't these amendments that you got from Legislative Counsel's office after your comments at the hearing the last time?
Mr. Chair, General Counsel, what you read, as I understand it, are the dash one amendments that were originally submitted by Representative Devlin.
I've got the dash two, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll get copies back and you can comment on it. It's my understanding that from Representative Devlin, that the purpose of this was to actually create a study for the creation of a possible pilot program for sex offender treatment. Is that right, Dr. Field?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Because there is no current sex offender treatment going on at the institution.
That is correct.
Okay. Excuse me?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ask the question, Representative Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Field, there is no sex offender treatment at all in the institution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, yes, that is correct. There is currently, nor for the last 4 years, has there been any sex offender treatment program in the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Can you tell me why?
Representative Walker, there's a history here that may be helpful. Going back about 6 years ago, there was a decision to close a residential program at Oregon State Hospital. That program, I think it's fair to say, demonstrated reasonable effectiveness, but it was a long-term program with a very, very low graduation rate of sometimes 3 or 4 individuals per year. And so the thought was at that time it simply was not cost-effective. There was then, up until about 4 years ago, a pre-release day treatment program located, we had two, one out in Ontario and one at a local Salem facility. At that point, the department, the governor's office, looked at sex offender treatment, all of the programs and corrections, against two very hard acid tests. The first one was, is the program legally mandated, either by law or by court action? And unlike, for example, mental health programs that one could assert are legally mandated, there is no current mandate for sex offender treatment. Failing that, there was a look at the programs from an effectiveness point of view. Is there clear and convincing evidence that each and every one of our programs is effective at reducing criminal recidivism? We could argue, for example, the alcohol and drug programs have that clear and convincing evidence. The sex offender treatment literature is probably best described these days as equivocal. The story that I tell people is that I probably have a stack of 8 inches of outcome research with regard to sex offender treatment, and approximately 4 of those inches of studies show no effect, including a general report by the U.S. General Accounting Office, which suggested little to no effect by sex offender treatment, and about half of those studies showed some effect. Within that mix of uncertainty of sex offender treatment, the most hopeful approach that we saw out there was close community supervision with concurrent community treatment, and that in fact has developed throughout most Oregon counties. So, long story, but the bottom line was the feeling across the state was to put the money into that close community supervision and concurrent community treatment after incarceration.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It raised a couple more questions for me. First of all, what is the percentage of the population in the male population in your prison system who are sex offenders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, currently that runs between about 28% and 30% of the male population are convicted sex offenders. However, I should hasten to say to you that that does not mean that 28% to 30% of the discharges are sex offenders, in that they tend to serve much longer sentences and are coming out at a much slower rate. Nevertheless, there are approximately 30 sex offenders released every month.
Whoa. Another question, please.
Follow up.
Sir, I have to tell you that I'm just a little shocked about what I'm hearing today. Very shocked. And I want to know what you're doing to protect the inmates inside the facility from these sex offenders, because we all know that sex offenders and, I mean, they have really disgusting words that describe them inside the prison, but how do you protect the inmate population from these people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that has been an area of concern. There have been several media reports recently about rapes and other sexual assaults that occur within prisons. The fact is that across the country, we don't know a lot about incidents of sexual assaults in prisons. We try to track that very closely within this state, and we believe we have, compared to many, many other states, a very low rate of sexual assaults. Now, my own particular area of expertise is mental health and alcohol and drug treatment. We take dramatic efforts to keep individuals who are mentally ill and who are mentally retarded, developmentally disabled, safe. By having programs for them when they come in, having case managers that see them regularly and track them to make sure that they're safe and that our most vulnerable inmates are not being abused. I certainly cannot say to you that sex abuse never occurs in prisons. We believe it's at a very low rate in Oregon prisons.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just continue to be alarmed by your testimony. We have Bell Measure 11 in Oregon, which is increasingly sending our young people into prison, into an environment where you tell me you believe you have a low sexual assault rate, but you don't know.
That's correct.
You don't deal with these people with their problems until they get released into the community. I'm just frankly shocked that here we are in the year 2001 and the system just doesn't know how to deal with it yet.
Doctor, let me ask you just a real frank question. Are you excited about the opportunity to put together a pilot program for this training within the institution?
Mr. Chair, we have looked at the various options if we were going to get back into the sex offender treatment business. And as a treatment provider, of course, internally, I'm very much an advocate for programs and program development. When we look at this area, however, we think that the single most effective thing we could do would be to support what I talked about before, the community, close community supervision and concurrent community treatment, but by providing a approximately 6-month pre-release program that would prepare sex offenders for community supervision and treatment. We have consistently received feedback from community supervision officers that when we did that, that was a very helpful thing. It helped them start the sex offenders out on the right road of community supervision and provided very tight accountability. So we would simply like, if we are going to look again at the possibility of providing sex offender treatment, to look at that fairly broadly. We think there are some models out there beyond the rather limited range of models in this bill. Within that context, yes, we'd like to look at those options.
But this bill doesn't do it for you, even with the amendments we've got in front of you, does it?
Mr. Chair, at the last hearing, I submitted some testimony suggesting some amendments that took, for example, the section on assessment and stated that a little more broadly to give us more options to come up with creatively and cost-effective measures. And then under subsection C, we offered that we would prefer taking out the words narrow range, the words 18 to 24 months and residential treatment. While those are reasonable considerations, we would prefer a broader range of considerations.
Okay, I want to pause and give you an opportunity to compare the dash two amendments to the bill and make sure that these are the amendments that you thought you were suggesting to us, Doctor.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
These are the correct amendments.
Okay. Counsel?
Chair, the main difference between these and the dash one amendments are that in line 7 after effective, they add screening or, and then in lines, they eliminate lines 11 and 12.
That's correct.
Are there any other questions? Okay. Hearing none, we have the amendments in front of us. I guess the question I pose to the committee is this something that we want to give them the opportunity to at least develop a plan for a pilot program on?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hugh Walker.
I would agree that this is something we should be doing. I'm frankly surprised, as you heard from my questions, that we do not have such a program in our facilities. I'm quite concerned about the inmate population when we've got 28% to 30% of them who are sex offenders. Preying on the other members of that population. I certainly understand that we have an investment in community programs once these people are released, but I think we have an obligation as a state to protect the population on the inside who are serving crimes for different things. I think this might be a way to get out that information.
Okay. Anybody else have a comment? Representative Ackerman.
Have we resolved the fiscal implications of this?
Oh, I'm sure we haven't. the fiscal is considerably less because it's a study to do a pilot program. I think the original version of the bill was drafted to reinstitute sex offender treatment, and even a study of full sex offender treatment was broader than just the study of the pilot program. I don't know, does the fiscal bring us in under 50, Bill?
Chairman of the committee, what will happen is that we send a copy of the amendments to legislative fiscal, and hopefully by the time we get the bill to full committee, they'll give us an idea. I'm pretty sure it's probably under 50,000, but Mr. Field is probably the person they'll call up and ask.
Thank you.
Am I correct?
Yes. Okay. Anybody else? We've got the dash two amendments in front of us, so I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3446. Is there any objection? Amendments adopted, and I move House Bill 3446 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Representative Vicki Walker, will you carry that to the full?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The last matter we have is House Bill 3787. I'll open a work session on that bill. My understanding is that we have some amendments in front of us. Council.
Thank you, Chair Williams. You have in front of you the dash three amendments. These are the results of a work group we put together with the City of Portland, the rental car folks, and a number of representatives from the law enforcement community. This bill was originally brought from the rental car industry that were concerned about practices in the City of Portland relating to fees charged for cars that were impounded pursuant to their civil forfeiture authority. This bill would tie the charging of fees to what's currently provided in law for certain impounds, and most significant would be the administrative fee that can be charged by the City of Portland would be limited to an amount sufficient to recover its actual administrative costs for impoundment. The City of Portland has agreed that with the changes in forfeiture law that would in fact be their practice, and the rental car industry has indicated that they would like that in statute, and the City of Portland has agreed to that.
So is that the, I've got a dash one and a dash two.
A dash three. You should have received a dash three this morning.
Do you have a three?
Yep. It was on our...
I'm not sure I had a three. Okay. Okay. Well, why don't we bring somebody from the car rental agency forward, and I see someone from the City of Portland. Why don't we bring everybody up and we'll have a little conversation. Everybody remembers this from the last hearing, I think. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and start with the Gardners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Hertz, Avis, et al. The committee council's description is accurate. The other salutary feature of the dash threes is that they do apply broadly to all innocent owners, not simply car rental companies, so that it serves the goal that I believe had been addressed in some of the questioning by the committee. If I may turn it over to my partner, Linda Gardner, for a detailed explanation. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Gardner with Gardner & Gardner, representing the same car rental companies as Jim Gardner. The existing law is set out at 809, 7.20, and basically it applies to only certain offenses, most specifically driving while, or only driving while suspended or revoked, driving while under the influence of intoxicants, and operating without a license or in violation of driving of restrictions. This bill would apply procedures contained in 809.720 to any ordinance authorizing impoundment that the City of Portland would enact. And basically, it would require the city to release the vehicle upon furnishing proof of ownership, proof of insurance, and having a person arrive, furnishing those items with a valid driver's license. Also, the city could charge towing and storage charges, as well as an administrative fee, which is calculated by reference to its actual administrative costs. Committee Council alluded to the fact that the costs would be limited, and that is a salutary effect of the bill. But another effect is that other waivers of rights would not be permitted to be required of an innocent owner, such as, waiver of the of any kind of affirmative defenses in forfeiture actions, which of course has been maybe a moot point now, but also a release of other rights, such as the ability to contest procedural defects and things like that.
Okay. Are there any questions from Ms. Gardner? Mr. Landauer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Just like to make a couple very brief points. This Amendment -3 would in fact apply to private persons. As you may recall, last session the legislature did pass a bill that would permit the forfeiture of vehicles driven by drunk drivers if they had been convicted within the last 3 years. This would prevent us from conducting a 50 or charge the individual for the investigation of a 50 statewide investigation to their driving record for the previous 3 years. That was a practice that we had done previously to ballot measure 3, but when ballot measure 3 was passed, all our forfeiture procedures came to a very abrupt halt. So I want you to be aware of the fact that this will prevent us from making that charge to the individual in the future if you do decide to pass this. The second thing I wanted to raise was that we want to be very clear that this bill will not prevent us, the law enforcement, to have a seizure for law enforcement purposes. What I'm trying to say specifically is that this would not prevent us from holding a vehicle, whether it be private or a rental car, for evidentiary purposes. If a vehicle was impounded, for example, under Dewey, and it became an officer had probable cause to believe that this vehicle was used in a bigger crime, for example, we would have to go and get a search warrant in order to retain that vehicle, search it, hold it for evidentiary purposes. If the under 807, or excuse me, 809-720, 3, sub 3, 4, and 5 were met, it is conceivable that that vehicle would have to be released. We want to make sure that the vehicle could be retained for evidentiary purposes. We don't believe that is the impact, but we just wanted to state that on the record that it is not the intent of this to prevent us from holding those vehicles for evidentiary purposes.
And Ms. Gardner, you agree that for purposes of when the vehicle has been used in the commission of the crime to which it becomes evidence, that they would be able to retain that, and this would not affect their current ability to hold those for crime scene or crime-related evidence. Is that right?
Chair Williams, that is not our intention for this bill.
Okay. Good. So I think we're all clear on that point. And to the extent legislative history matters, we have now made some. Is there any other questions about this issue or about the -3 amendments? Okay. Thank you. We have the -3s in front of us. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay. Representative Ackerman moves the adoption of the -3 amendments to House Bill 3787. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, they're adopted. Representative Ackerman? Move to submit House Bill 3787 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman has moved House Bill 3787 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move to the full committee and we adjourn. Representative Ackerman, will you carry that bill to the full committee?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Was that done today? 3642?